This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Anote Tong, former president of Kiribati and international climate change activist, joins us in the studio this morning. He'll be speaking tonight at the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater. The theater will be screening the documentary Anote's Ark, which tells the story of the Kiribati people's ongoing fight to save their nation from changing weather patterns. Take a listen to highlights from the trailer.
Kiribati is in the center of the world. So it's right there, bang in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So far away, so isolated, we thought it would be immune from the tribulations of this world.
The issue of climate change remains the most pressing challenge for us in Kiribati.
For those of us on the front line, it really does not matter what is agreed to in Paris, because we will continue to go underwater.
What is going to happen to us is going to be the fate of the rest. We will fall.
Anote Tong has twice been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize and has been recognized for his work in environmental protection. Welcome this morning.
Thank you for having me.
It is so nice to have you here in studio. Describe to our listeners what Kiribati looks like. How large is it?
Well, it's as I said, it's in the middle of the world because it's spread up above the equator and below the equator and also east and west of the international dateline. The total landmass is not much more than 800 square kilometers, but so spread over 3.5 million square kilometers of ocean. The islands are atolls, and therefore very fragile. Hardly the average height would be of the land above sea level would be 2 meters is a bit liberal even.
Wow, so very vulnerable.
Very, very vulnerable. We, in a sense, we are a bit fortunate where we are located on the equator because we're in the doldrums, the boring part of the weather pattern. We don't get anything exciting.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Typhoon Alley in Guam, so I'm used to large storms, but I can see that your tiny island would be just so exposed.
We're not structured to withstand any kind of a storm. Sometimes we've had some winds, moderate, maybe 40 knots is severe for us, and if it were to coincide with a spring tide, a king tide, then the damage would be quite enormous. We have experienced this, and even recently as well.
So your greatest fear then is that the change in the climate patterns, I guess.
More so rather than the rise in sea level, because the rise in sea level is very gradual, but I think it's the increasing temperature, which would, of course, increase the energy and perhaps even the storms coming our way, which should not be coming our way.
And I know we here in Hawaii have been hearing more about king tides, and it is pretty alarming to see how far up the wash is in Waikiki, even where you're staying this week.
Right. Well, we are seeing events. At the end of last year, we had floodings. We had king tides. The king tides keep coming more often than they used to be. So there was flooding at the end of last year. Some islands suffered damage to their homes. And also at the beginning of this year. So, as I said, we're seeing it more frequently and with much greater intensity.
And so this film that's going to be screened tonight, what's the message out there?
Well, I've been on this path for more than a decade and a half now. And it's about getting that message across because I know it's a very difficult message to convey to people, especially people who believe that what is happening on climate change has no relevance to their lives. And we have a lot of that. And so just because it doesn't happen in one go, it doesn't happen like a typhoon or a cyclone, it really doesn't matter. But I think the difference between what is happening on climate change is it keeps coming. It doesn't recede. Whereas you might get a typhoon, but it goes. And so that is the problem we will continue to face.
And what's the population of your island?
We've got over 100,000 people, but getting to maybe 110, and spread over the many islands that we have.
So you've been on this mission, really, worldwide, talking about the plight of your nation's, your country. You were just in, was it New Zealand or Australia?
I've just come back from Australia to speak at the Australasian Emissions Reduction Summit. And this is what the Australians tried to do in response to climate change. This is, it's an interesting forum because it engages people from different sides of the debate, including energy companies. And so it's about people who feel threatened by climate change, but also people who might feel threatened by the remedies being proposed to deal with climate change.
And so you had mentioned earlier before the show that for Australia it was interesting because they're in the middle of elections, correct?
Well, they're in the final stages of the campaign. The election is in a few days, just around about a week. And climate has become the top of the agenda, which is very interesting because this happened quite recently. I was there in October last year, and it was creeping up to the top of the agenda. Following the action by the young people, the students, to march and protest on this, it really has come up to the top of the agenda. And so the question for the parties involved in campaigning, what is going to be their policy on climate change?
Yes, and there are some very hard questions that they're going to have to ask and some tough policies that they may have to draft.
Definitely. When my talks last year, and I keep saying it, you know, you people in Australia may think that climate change is not relevant to your life. But I assure you, in the next summer, you will experience your bushfires. You will experience your storms and your droughts. And maybe not you directly, but people you know. And if it doesn't touch anybody relevant to you, next time it might. But definitely, the march of climate change will continue if we do not do anything about it.
And Australia's landmass is vast compared to our tiny islands.
Well, they're not on the front line. In terms, we mustn't make the mistake of thinking that because we are low level, we are the only ones that are going to suffer. Because climate change impacts come in different forms. To us, the immediate danger is the rising seas, the increasing intensity of the storms, and what damage it could. But for countries like Australia, it's about bushfires, it's about the storms which are coming more frequently, which with much greater intensity, and of course the droughts which are affecting their farmers.
And so when you go out across the globe talking about this issue, what do you say about the children of Kiribati?
Well, I say because, as you pointed out very correctly, I used to do this as a leader. Now I do this as a grandfather. I have, I think, 18 grandchildren. My wife knows them precisely.
Congratulations.
But for me, it's real. It's very personal. And it's about voicing the concerns of all the grandparents in Kiribati and beyond, even here in Hawaii, because this is about the future of the generations coming.
And you mentioned that you're staying in Waikiki for this trip, and you've come here many times. What are you struck by when you come to a place like Hawaii, and you've seen the changes yourself?
Yes, well, Hawaii's Honolulu is quite a different world from the kind of world that I know. Of course, you're pulled along with the tide of leisure and pleasure, and so the concerns that would be steering me back home seem to be in the background when you're in a situation like this. And I think that is what makes it a little difficult sometimes for people to truly understand the gravity of what is coming.
And anything else you would like to share just as you go on this journey to broadcast your message?
Okay, I think what's important is for each and every one of us, to truly understand that whatever we do is relevant to what will happen to the future of this planet and to people like my grandchildren and your grandchildren.
And do you feel that the message is getting through, that people are receptive to that?
Much more than it was the case when I started talking in 2004. there's a great deal of change, but we're still missing the concrete solutions that need to be put in place.
And what about funding? Where do you see that?
I would not depend entirely on the international community coming forward, but we have a lot of resources. We have one of the largest fishery resources in the world, but we get a very tiny part of it. So we need to enhance the rate of return in order to build the climate resilience we need.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Our in-studio guest is the former president of Kiribati, who will be speaking tonight at the Honolulu Museum of Art following a screening of the film Anote's Ark. Find the details on our Facebook page, The Conversation HPR.
How can squeezing hydrogen between two diamonds make the next superconductor? I'm Ira Flatow on the next Science Friday, the frustrating quest for the most elusive material in physics. Plus, what happens when a lion bites a porcupine? Well, it may seek less painful prey, you. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Island Insurance, and Sacred Hearts Academy.
Earlier this morning, we had two other guests in studio. Catherine Healy is a longtime advocate who worked to decriminalize the sex trade in New Zealand. She was recognized for her work with Queen Elizabeth, bestowing the honor of becoming a dame. She sat down with us along with Tracy Ryan of Harm Reduction Hawaii, a local advocacy group, to talk about the issues in the sex trade, along with Dame Healy's efforts to organize the New Zealand's Prostitutes Collective in 1986.
We formed our organization in 1987 on the back of concerns about the law and the way we were perceived as sex workers. And we also had grave concerns about public health and HIV and so on, and, you know, sexually transmissible infections. So we had an interest in organising, and, the Ministry of Health, as it was, or Department of Health at that time it was called, contracted with us to run an educative program throughout our peer groups.
And so you were here this week to put on a workshop, a presentation at the state capitol yesterday.
I've been speaking across the states about the decriminalization of sex work. In New Zealand, we decriminalized in 2003. And I say in a context, it was a limited model, but it's the most progressive model that we have to date in the world.
And so who attended yesterday's session?
Well,
Tracy, do you want to jump in here?
I have the sign-in sheet. So it was mostly public officials, people in public health, some people from the Capitol. There was someone from the Attorney General's office, someone from public safety. Mostly the people who are, you know, not the ordinary general public, but mostly people in government and in different areas of public health and social service.
And the whole objective of this gathering was really to start the conversation about, what's been happening in New Zealand and what might happen here?
Well, yeah, we've been, this is an ongoing effort of bringing in speakers from offshore who are involved in the industry and have become advocates for change. And we have brought in five or six people over the last year and a half, and made a number of presentations. And as a result of that, there's become a group of sex workers who have begun to organize because one of them came to the meeting and saying, look, I'm isolated. I'm working off the internet. There's no one I can talk to. I don't really have friends. I have no one watching my back, which is a bad situation for anyone to be in, particularly if you're in an industry where there are harms and dangers. And so that genesis is kind of now moving the ball forward in terms of public discussion. We want to generate as much civil discussion on these issues as we can. We know there are a lot of people who don't agree with some of the things we're saying, and some of them are very adamant about that. But there are also people who are share our concerns who may not be on our side, who are willing to talk civilly about moving forward, and those are the kind of people we're reaching out to.
And so can you talk about your work in New Zealand and maybe how difficult it was in those early days and then to get this honor by the Queen of England?
Well, the work very quickly became about tensions between government departments. So we had, on the one hand, had the contract with the Department of Health to run an HIV prevention program. And on the other hand, we had the police arresting us for distributing health department-sponsored condoms. So very quickly, we had to focus the community in on the need to decriminalise sex work. So that became a big part. What we did was we built a coalition with different women's organisations, public health, people with an interest in human rights, and we had an eclectic focus group, you know, including, you know, Catholic nuns and even the Salvation Army supported our move to decriminalise sex work. So it was very intense and very focused. And the Parliament passed it by one vote in 2003. And I guess, you know, if I reflect on those early days when we were being arrested to the current time of being awarded the stay mod, I could not have predicted. A lot of people say the sky will fall in if you decriminalise sex work. What bollocks. That, you know, what absolute nonsense, you know. So in some ways, New Zealanders are very proud of the fact that I've been given this honour because we're paving the way for, you know, respect for sex workers, human rights, protection from exploitation. We also swung the law around to protect minors instead of, you know, having them in a situation where that'd be precarious. We repositioned the law to protect them. So a lot of things were achieved when the politicians came together and put that vote forward.
And then how different is the system in New Zealand, let's say, compared to, you know, here in Hawaii or across the United States?
Across the United States, I've been very distressed to hear that there has been a pattern of arrests. New Zealand's a little nation. It's 4.5 million. Our biggest city is Auckland, which is the same population as Hawaii, 1.5 million. And, you know, the discussions I've heard across the country here have been similar, like all the same debates, you know, all the same concerns, etc. But I'm really struck that there seems to be such energy in the sex worker rights movement and you know, consensus that something needs to change and, you know, that sex workers need these protections. If you're serious about anti-trafficking initiatives, this is the way to do it. You'd be hard-pressed to find people in New Zealand who would say, let's wind back the clock and reposition ourselves a la United States. You know, people are totally in favour, I think, now of having decriminalised sex work.
And Tracy, weigh in on this. So what are your thoughts about that? Do you think it's going to be an easy road?
No, but it is a road. And whether the road is easy or hard, you just put your nose down and you take the road. And I've been working on this issue for 22 years, so it's not new to me. The opposition, the nature of it has changed. When I got involved back in the middle 90s, most of it was community concerns about visible prostitution in their neighborhoods, in Chinatown and Waikiki. That was the issue. Now it's more that, oh, well, people are arguing that if we have a more legal system for consenting adults, then that means there'll be more sex trafficking, which I'm not exactly sure how that logic follows. But if you read, you know, the writings and stuff from this, these people who are advocating, you realize very quickly that that's not really their issue at all. Their issue is that they feel that the existence of a of prostitution and some other things like stripping and adult anything is bad for the women's community, and it makes men feel that they have the right to women's bodies, that women can't have equality. And so those concerns trump the harm that's done by the laws which are being enforced against individual women in the sex trades. And I feel, in terms of the way that the United States is supposed to be set up, that individual rights are supposed to be respected. And any kind of great moral agenda that anyone has, whether they call it Christianity or feminism, shouldn't be allowed to harm people who aren't doing anything other than consenting acts of adults.
And we've been, watching the headlines across the country, really, you know, from Florida, where the dragnet has netted some big fish and big names, to here in Honolulu, where the city prosecutor's office is cracking down.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, in terms of the Florida thing, this is another of a series of highly publicized police operations. There was one in Kings County, Washington. There have been ones in Vancouver and otherwise, where they came out with big announcements that they were busting these great trafficking things and blah, 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 where, you know, shortly thereafter, when the evidence came out, there was no trafficking. But the press has spent a lot less time reporting on what actually happened when the evidence came out than what all these police grandstanding was. They haven't found sex trafficking in Florida, but they're still cracking down. And they didn't find it in Kings County, but they still spent a bunch of pretty harmless people to prison.
And then here in Honolulu?
We had the Alun farm labor case, as many of us remember,
right,
where, you know, this was a big, you know, human trafficking case. And when it got to court, and the prosecutor, it came out that their chief witness for the prosecutor had lied. And he changed his lie when he realized they couldn't threaten him with prison because it was ex post facto, it was prior to the offense. He changed his story, and that case was dismissed. So all these other elements of this case, when you looked at the actual evidence, were different than what was being reported by law enforcement. So we get a problem with people in law enforcement who are getting a big feather in the cap for breaking a trafficking thing because they're so rare.
Right.
In terms of prosecution.
And you're tracking what's happening also with the prosecutor's office,
yes,
and the bus there.
We are very concerned that there is no apparent reason that this is happening, and we'll be following this story as it develops. But the statistics we have from HPD indicate they've made no arrests in the last 2 years for anyone under this trafficking law. FBI statistics indicate 2 people in the last 2 years, and even by the prosecution's admissions, there are no evidence of sex trafficking they found in any of these busts. So this doesn't have anything to do with sex trafficking. So what exactly is the motivating factor for spending all these resources?
Right.
That we have to find out.
And so, and what are your thoughts as you go from, you know, city to city and you see headlines like this in the news?
I am relieved. We don't have this model. It's dysfunctional. That we have decriminalized sex work, and I want to explain, you know, that decriminalization isn't, you know, it's about positioning sex workers as a part of society. It's not about putting them outside, and so it's not that we don't have regulations. We certainly have a model, a framework that we recognize sex workers' work, and we allow for operators of brothels, they can be held to account. We had a famous case where a sex worker was awarded $25,000 for being sexually harassed verbally, not physically, by her boss. So she took that case to a human rights review tribunal who had a hearing, and she was awarded $25,000, and the operator of the brothel was instructed to have sexual harassment training, which, you know, is what you would do in other workplaces. So our relationship with the police is much better. They would not wish to see a return to the bad old days where they used to register our names, intrude on our privacy, and arrest us was, you know, the ultimate kind of thing that they did against us. So, you know, the model, I'm pleased we have it. We haven't we haven't got everything we'd like. You know, we'd like to see anti-discrimination legislation. We also have a clause in the legislation that says you cannot immigrate to New Zealand with the intention of being a sex worker. So that in and of itself is quite discriminatory. So if you're packing your bags, think again if you're going to come to New Zealand and be a sex worker. But in the main, we have a very, very solid model and 17 years of it.
It's a big deal.
It's a big deal, and you know, it hangs together.
That was New Zealand sex trade advocate Dame Catherine Healy and Tracy Ryan of Harm Reduction Hawaii talking with us about issues around a move to decriminalize the sex trade. Highway woe is still an issue on Kauai. That's the subject of our reality check this morning. Honolulu Civil Beat's Alan Pellerkini. Pellerkini joins us live on the line. Good morning.
Hi, Catherine.
So did you get stuck in the landslide last week?
I have been stuck in that traffic, I think, four times now.
Oh, my
gosh.
And
it's for, I was just over at the shopping center at Princeville, which is the next town my side of Hanalei, this morning, and as you can imagine, there is a strong sense of people hoping that the road reopening past Hanalei, which is now scheduled for in the next couple of weeks, that was the end of the post-storm crisis. But now we have this landslide condition that's developed on the highway just this side of Hanalei that's going to have one lane closed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for at least 4 or 5 months. And there's the business community is just in complete turmoil about this.
Well, I feel for the community. I mean, my gosh, everybody thought, you know, we were on the road to recovery. And then thank goodness that nobody got hurt.
So far, anyway, fortunately, they figured out that this was about to completely collapse before it could. And so that's a good thing, that we didn't have a disaster incident that precipitated this closure. And I think everyone is thankful for that. On the other hand, at the moment, from my house to Hanalei, which I live in Kilauea, which is the next town past Princeville, typically would be maybe a 15-20-minute drive, is now an hour to an hour and a half. And I was talking to somebody who lives in my neighborhood this morning who works in Hanalei, and her commute is now an hour and a half in each direction. So this is a big deal to everyone who lives on the North Shore.
The unstable hillside really is, I mean, it's an issue statewide. I mean, we saw it here with the Pali, and, you know, that's still closed. But I'm sure the tension is... you know, you've had this back and forth with the State Highways Division about, you know, whether or not they were pushing to move that,
right,
that big highway and open it up.
Right. And that was resolved. The state backed down. They were going to reopen the highway about May 1st, which would have been a disaster in the sense that the repair work really isn't finished yet. They're rebuilding three bridges, and those aren't done yet. So it would have been unleashing a torrent of tourist traffic on a road that wasn't ready to receive it. And they backed down and put that off until, at the moment, I think the date they're bandying about is May 20th. But now you have a situation where getting to and from Hanalei under any circumstances at any time of the day or night is going to be a very problematic proposition.
So do we know what the issues in the Hanalei area are going to do, you know, to the rest of the highway?
Well, that hasn't been addressed yet. At the moment, the plan to reopen the highway past Hanalei on on or about May 20th is unchanged. I frankly would not be surprised. I was just out there a few days ago, and they're still working, and it would not surprise me if, even without the landslide in question, the reopening was delayed again. Now, what this all means in terms of what will happen now with the full lane closure at all times of the day and night happening before you get to Hanalei, it's just an enormously complicated situation. And the people I feel for a lot are the business people, both the owners and the people who work in businesses in Hanalei, because they're really going to be in a difficult situation. They've been in a difficult situation since the storms last year with the road closure. Now with this latest development, they're even worse off. The community is just in tension, and it's all people were talking about at the Foodland in Princeville this morning, I can tell you, because I was there.
I'm sure. I mean, that's going to affect the entire community, and I guess we'll have to see how this shuttle system works.
Well, the shuttle, that's an interesting question. The shuttle would start at Princeville and go to KA Beach, but that was before the lane closure, so the shuttle will have to go sit in the traffic jam and wait just like everybody else, going in both directions. And I spoke with a guy who's organizing that shuttle yesterday, Joel Guy. He's quoted in the story I have on Civil Beat this morning, and he's not at all sure how the shuttle is going to proceed. There's been no announced change in the plan to start it on or about June 4th, but how the shuttle is actually going to work in practice with 1 hour delays in each direction just is impossible to predict at this point.
All right. Well, keep us posted, but thanks so much for giving us the update.
Sure enough.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat's Alan Parrachini with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, go to civilbeat.org. Seniors at the University of Hawaii are preparing for graduation this weekend. Today, a small group of those students will be commissioned as officers in the U.S. military. But before they do that, Army ROTC cadets at UH had to go through intensive training modeled on a battle in which a former University of Hawaii cadet was killed in action. HPR's Ryan Finnerty joined them for a training. Take a listen.
11 days in the wake-up.
11 days, baby.
All we gotta do is survive or not.
In the summer of 2008, just 12 days before the end of a 15-month deployment, a small group of American soldiers in the remote mountains of eastern Afghanistan came under attack from a large group of Taliban fighters. 49 American soldiers assigned to the small combat outpost in the town of Wanat were confronted by a well-organized assault by more than 120 Taliban. The attack did not come as a surprise. Retired Army Master Sergeant David Zwick was the senior enlisted soldier at the American outpost. He says a large Taliban force had been observed just a few miles to the north of Wanat.
That large number that is known to be there didn't just disappear when you're a couple miles away from Wanat. So it is known there is a sizable, well-supplied force in the area.
Despite that intelligence, the platoon had been ordered to dig in. First Lieutenant Jonathan Brostrom, a 2006 graduate of the University of Hawaii at Manoa, was charged with leading the mission. When the Taliban attack began, Lieutenant Brostrom and his soldiers quickly found themselves in a fight for their lives. They were attacked from multiple sides. The enemy had the high ground. The small American base was located at the bottom of a steep river valley. Sergeant Zwick describes the challenge.
They would always know where we were at and could plan on where we would be, and it was very difficult to counteract that.
Using the terrain to their advantage, the Taliban were able to advance within 100 yards of the base perimeter, too close to safely use air support. They were closing in on a lightly manned observation post just above the base. Lieutenant Brostrom quickly gathered a few reinforcements and led a charge through the approaching enemy forces. He was killed in action shortly after reaching his men.
ABC News has obtained never-before-seen video of a ferocious battle that took place near the capital of Kabul, as seen by the Taliban. It shows an enemy well-trained, organized, and prepared. Here's our senior foreign correspondent.
That battle is the focus for about 30 students at the University of Hawaii. They're cadets in the school's Army ROTC program, sitting in the same seats where Jonathan Brostrom sat just a few months before he deployed to Afghanistan. The Army has painstakingly recreated the battle at Wannat, complete with an interactive 3D digital map of the area. Cadets can see exactly what the Americans on the ground and the Taliban saw. Veterans of the battle, like Sergeant Zwick, call in via Skype to share their experience. The cadets discuss tactical decisions and see how they played out. The program is presented to Army units all over the world, but cadets at the University of Hawaii get something that no other unit in the Army does, Jonathan Brostrom's father.
The war was really getting bad at that time. He was commissioned right when Iraq was just going south. We were losing. Little did I know that things were going south in Afghanistan.
David Brostrom is a retired Army colonel and a Vietnam veteran who lives in Hawaii. He received a call from his son in Afghanistan after one of his son's soldiers was killed in an earlier incident.
He would call home about once a week, about 3 a.m. in the morning. We always knew who it was, and my wife would answer, and he goes, "Hey, Mom, everything's going fine. Tell Dad everything's fine." Sometimes he'd talk to me, sometimes he wouldn't. On this particular occasion, my wife said, "Hey, he wants to talk to you," and I said, "Something's wrong." And then he said, "Dad, I just lost my platoon sergeant. He was shot and killed today. Well, I don't know what to do." And I wanted to tell him, "Hell, I don't know what to do either. I mean, I've never been in that situation." You know, I had to think about it, and I said, "Well, it sounds like you're in a pretty precarious position," because he told me the platoon sergeant's body had been there a couple days because they couldn't get in to evacuate the body because of weather. And I said, you know, you got to do your grieving away from your soldiers and show them that you can continue the mission and not be a jumble of nerves. Because if you come out as weak, more soldiers will sense that, and they could be killed. And then you'll have morale problems. So you got to be strong."
But the call left David Brostrom deeply unsettled. He began looking into the situation and didn't like what he found.
You know, after the phone call, man, I was very worried about him. Something was not going right. And my son didn't know any better. He didn't have the experience. He was just doing what he was told, trying to survive and leading the soldiers. But, you know, I was looking at it in more of an operational, strategic level, and I said, "Boy, this is really bad. Something else must be bad for them to put these soldiers in this position."
After his son died, Colonel Brostrom made it his mission to find out what happened at Wannat and help future officers at the University of Hawaii learn from it.
You just have to capture the lessons learned so it doesn't happen again. My instinct says there's a lot to learn here. We don't want to forget the mistakes we made. But the most important thing are the decisions that the chain of command made. The decisions they made at the time, they thought were probably the right decisions. But when you look at it today, there are a lot of mistakes. So hopefully these young men and women will take that to heart and learn something so they don't make the same mistakes if they ever get put in that situation. And if for some small part Jonathan can become a hero to these young men and women or an example, then I try to make that a reality.
Responsibility for preparing these college students to become military leaders falls to Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Gregory, the commander of the university's ROTC program. Before the training began, he told the cadets that if the experience didn't make them emotional, they were in the wrong business.
"We saw and we learned today about First Lieutenant Jonathan Brostrom's actions in Battle of Wannat. And as future leaders, if they can't see that connection that he had with his soldiers and the concern and the care and how he was willing to put his life at risk for theirs, if they can't see that and if it doesn't resonate with them instantly to their core of their being, then this is absolutely the wrong profession, because at some point they may be put in John Brostrom's position in the same life or death choice."
For Gregory, this type of training is invaluable in helping him prepare the cadets to become officers.
"The Battle of Wannat takes all of the lessons that we have taught over the 4 years of education and distills it down into one discrete event. Today we talked about leadership, we talked about loyalty, we talked about discipline. Today makes it real. today takes all of these classroom lessons and says, now here's a young leader who was formerly one of you, whose picture you walk by every single day on our Hall of Honor. And here's how he took all of the lessons that you have learned and applied it to his soldiers and applied it to an absolutely horrible situation. And here's how he continued to fight for his men. It just takes everything over 4 years, brings it all together into one moment, one time, to show what it means to be an officer and what it means to be a leader.
Maria Garrett is one of those cadets who will graduate this year. For her, the training hit close to home. Before enrolling at UH, she served in the unit that had been attacked at Wenat.
It's a very humbling experience. One, to have been honored to have the presence of a Gold Star father, the father of Lieutenant Brostrom, there to input and give us perspective, as well as thinking of how we apply all the things we've learned through our time in ROTC, critically thinking, okay, if I was in this situation, how would I react? Using those skills to do that. Also, I served in the same unit as Lieutenant Brostrom, so just feeling very proud of that legacy from UH Army ROTC and also 173rd.
As Maria and her classmates receive their diplomas, they will also assume the responsibility of leading the men and women who are still in Afghanistan, fighting the nation's longest war. I'm Ryan Finnerty for Hawaii Public Radio.
If you want to see photos from the Battle of Wenat training exercises or the UH ROTC program's memorial for fallen alumni, we'll have them posted on our Instagram page. We're at The Conversation, HPR.
On the next Fresh Air.
I'm not sure about this part where I say I want to be president for all Americans. I mean, do I? You know, all of them.
The finale of HBO's satirical political series Veep is this Sunday. We'll feature interviews with two of the stars, Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Tony Hale, and the showrunner, David Mandel. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, right after Science Friday.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Chaminade University and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
Opening a business can be hard in Hawaii, but one operation is finding early success in highlighting local fruits in hard cider. HPR's Casey Harlow has more about the challenges faced by a local startup.
In a commercial building in Lower Kalihi, the sweet and pungent smells of fermenting fruits fill the tank room of Paradise Ciders. I'm handed a sample of a pale yellow cider.
That's our Grapefruit Sunrise. That was a fresh juice. Grapefruit and a little bit of coriander for a little bit of like a grapefruit shandy slash grapefruit wit sort of flavor profile.
Yeah, it kind of has a sour note to it.
Yeah, yeah. It's got plenty of tartness like from the citrus.
It's here that Paradise Ciders is hoping to ride the wave of a new trend in craft beverages, hard cider, an alcoholic beverage made from fermented apple juice. Cider is following on the popularity of craft beer that first gained attention about 20 years ago. It's only been in recent years that craft breweries have opened successfully in Hawaii, and now Paradise Ciders is hoping to put a local spin on cider.
My name is Sean Peck. I'm one of the co-founders and owners of Paradise Ciders.
Casey Solheim, same.
Sean started experimenting with home brewing in his teens, and like most home brewers, he started by making beer. But he wanted something a little more refreshing and enjoyable.
So I started actually trying ciders, because growing up I'd always had like the Martinellis during like Thanksgiving or special occasions. Then I started dipping in and trying other ciders I could find on the market, and it was kind of a huge spectrum. It was either super sweet or super bone dry, whereas like champagne. I couldn't find something that I really enjoyed in between, So I decided to try to make it myself.
Sean would spend his weekends brewing ciders and giving it to friends. He met Casey while working as a bartender at the Yard House in Waikiki, and they started making cider together in Sean's garage. But then a hit and run changed everything. Sean was sideswiped on his motorcycle and broke his hip.
And it put me out, couldn't walk for about 5 months. The cool thing about that was it gave me a lot of time to, I mean, not just ponder about life, but where the direction of where I'm going in my life. And then also gave me a lot of free time to be looking on Craigslist for locations.
He and Casey were immediately sold on their leased space in Kalihi. It already had a commercial kitchen, and the rest of the building was occupied by a fruit packaging company. Sean says it was a match made in heaven. But before they could start making cider, they needed to get legal.
Between working two jobs, also sitting on the phone with TTB and running around to all these different little permitting departments. It was exciting though, because every once in a while you get some success and you'd be like, hey, we got approved for this, or I got some good news about that. And so it kind of kept us going.
Like many breweries, Paradise Ciders found itself paying rent even before they made a dollar. Bart Watson, chief economist with the Brewers Association, says small startup breweries and cideries face several challenges.
I think the first is that it's a capital-intensive business, and you know, raising that much money, particularly for a startup, is a challenge for any business. Secondly, they're small businesses, and you know, any small business is difficult, from financing to staffing to all the other challenges that a small business would face.
9 months after signing their lease, Sean and Casey were legal and began making cider. It didn't take long for things to start falling into place. When they first entered the market, they only had one cider.
About maybe 2 months in, everyone's like, so what's the next flavor?
It's like, it's mango
season.
What
else you got? Yeah. You know, and it's like, oh, wait.
Yeah.
So we started making a couple other flavors.
The fruits they use in their ciders are either shipped in or grown locally. They've even made cider from fruits people bring into their shop. Casey and Sean say they've seen a growth in demand for their ciders, and not only among millennials who have taken to the drink.
The majority of the people are wanting something that's easy to drink, but gives them a nice buzz, but it's kind of crafty too.
Paradise Ciders has 6 main varieties that can be found in Oahu bars and restaurants and a couple of places in Maui. Sean and Casey are planning to add more fermentation tanks, and eventually they would like to bottle and can their creations for retail sale and defy the odds of survival for new local businesses.
That was HPR's Casey Harlow reporting, and now he joins us live in the studio to tell us more about Paradise Ciders and hard cider in the state. Welcome, Casey.
Hi, thanks, Catherine, for having me on.
You know, I have a confession. I've never had a hard cider. I've had maybe carbonated apple juice. Is it kind of like that?
Kind of like Martinelli's?
Yeah, kind of. So is a hard cider sweet?
A hard cider can range from super sweet to bone dry like champagne. That's how Sean would describe it, and that's the reason why he got into making his own cider, was because he couldn't find something that was in a nice in between the two. So to kind of just describe cider in general, it's apple juice, basically. It's not necessarily sweet. It's kind of hard to explain. You kind of have to try it in order to kind of get a gauge for it.
Right, but it's kind of the base for whatever they do, I
yes.
guess.
So ciders legally have to be made from fermented apple juice. So what they do differently is you don't taste any apples at all. You don't taste the apple juice. They put the guavas out in the forefront of the flavor profile. They also have a lilikoi. The lilikoi was the first flavor that they did. So the lilikoi cider, the taste of lilikoi is out in front.
So I imagine, though, you need a lot of fruit.
Oh, definitely. They have their local connections. They wouldn't share that with me. But yes, they get fruit from farms, from people's yards, and sometimes they have to ship it in because sometimes there's not enough.
And so are they on the lookout for anything in particular?
Yes, they are on the lookout for mountain apples. So if you have mountain apples growing in your yard, or you have a property that grows mountain apples, they would like to make a mountain apple cider.
Oh, that would be interesting. I mean, because that flavor is subtle.
Yes, exactly. And kind of going back to the guava one that they have, it's called guava lava. Guava is a subtle flavor in general. So it kind of takes a little bit. It's a subtle flavor. It kind of takes a little bit to drink, and then you get that flavor profile from the guava
okay.
in their cider.
But there's no place that I can actually go. I can just go to my supermarket and buy a can of this stuff.
No, not necessarily. They are hoping to eventually get to that point. But right now, they only have their tasting room in Kalihi, and that's where you can get it. And it's also on tap in a bunch of bars or restaurants in town here, also a couple places in Maui.
Oh, okay. So they're expanding over to the neighbor islands.
Yes, only in two places in Maui, and they're owned by Merriman's Restaurants.
Ah, okay. So that's a tip.
Yeah, exactly.
And so is it more expensive?
Not necessarily. It's around the same price range as any craft brew that you would get here, especially local ones.
Okay. Well, I'll have to sample. I mean, I must say, I just discovered a sour beer the other day and was like, whoa, that made me pucker.
Yeah. Sometimes ciders can get that tart, but yeah, sour ales and ciders completely different. They would describe ciders closer to wine. The process is more the same as wine.
All right. Well, I'll keep my eyes out. It is Aloha Friday, Pauhana Friday. Maybe I'll go check one out. Thanks so much, Casey. And you can find Casey's story about hard ciders online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
I'm Thomas Hübel, the founder of the Academy of Inner Science, and next time on New Dimensions, I will be talking about how to manifest a more awake life in day-to-day practice.
Sunday morning at 11.
That's it for this week. Coming up next week, jury selection begins for the public corruption trial of Chief Louis K. Aloha and his wife, Catherine. A blueprint for our Hawaii schools for the next decade, Hawaii School Superintendent wants your feedback. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. You know, our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn Grusby. The backyard theme quiz was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up the conversation.